ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
चैप्टर 11 टेक्स्ट 32। श्री भगवान उवाच। कलोस्मि लोकक्षय कृत प्रविधो लोकान् समाहर्तुम् इह प्रवृत्तः ऋते पीत्वां न भविष्यन्ति सर्वे ये वस्तिता प्रात्यनिकेषु योधाः। Translation: the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Time I am, the great destroyer of the worlds, and I've come here to destroy all people, with the exception of you, the Pandavas. All the soldiers here on both sides will be slain." I'll read it again. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Time I am." You don't have to repeat. I'll just say it again. "The great destroyer of the worlds, and I have come here to destroy all people. With the exception of you, the Pandavas, all the soldiers here on both sides will be slain." This is a famous verse. I was kind of surprised that this is my verse. This verse is famous. Kalo asmi loka kshay krit pravridaha. That's a famous verse. Kalo asmi, I am time. Loka kshay krit, the cause of the destruction of the world. Pravridha, the mighty cause of the destruction of the world. This verse is famous because Oppenheimer, the theoretical physicist who constructed the first atomic bomb, Project Trinity, the atomic bomb that ended World War II, when we bombed the Japanese at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, we being the United States. I can't say we because... So when the bomb exploded, Oppenheimer thought about this verse. He thought about another verse about the 1,000 suns rising in the sky. Divi Sahasreshu Suryaha. That verse also. In the same chapter, if 1,000 suns rose at the same time, that might be the splendor of the Vishvarup, the form Krishna was showing Arjuna. But he also thought of this one. He mentioned it years later in an interview that he was thinking about this verse when the... And he was a Sanskrit pundit. And he translated the Gita, and he said, "I am death." So it says, "Time I am," and he says, he translated this, "I am death." Which actually is a pretty good translation. It's actually a pretty clean translation. You know, in Spanish, if you want to say, in English you say, "I'm between a rock and a hard place." It means like I'm in a situation where if I do this, it's bad, and if I do this, it's bad. I'm sure you have a Hindi equivalent. If I do this, it's a problem. And if I do this, it's a problem. Same thing, right? In Spanish, you say I'm between a sword and a wall. So if you translate English into Spanish, you don't translate it exactly. Because if you translate it exactly, no one will know what you're talking about. You follow? You have to translate it culturally and use the same example in the other language. What is it in Hindi? I'm between a well and a ditch. Yeah. Same thing. So if you translate that into English, you'd say between a rock and a hard place. You follow? So I am death is not actually a bad, it's, although it's not literal, it's not actually a bad translation. It's a decent translation. Let's look at the Sanskrit. Everybody's got a book, right? This is like a pundit class. Everybody's looking at the book. Okay, so Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Krishna speaking, Kalo Asmi, I am time, Loka, the world, Kshay Krit, the maker of the destruction of the world, Pravridha, the great maker of the destruction of the world. Lokan Samahartum Iha Pravrittaha. I come forth, or I'm engaged. This is interesting because the word Pravritta here, the last word of the second line, by the way, this whole thing is in Tristub meter, four lines of 11 syllables each. And in Sanskrit, in the Gita, but in Sanskrit literature in general, if you're in an Anustup meter, if you're four lines of 8 syllables each, which is what 90% of the Gita is, and you switch to the longer verses, it indicates what? This indicates something. Anybody know? Want to guess?
Something important,
heightened emotion, ecstasy, fear, some type of like kind of escalation in the normal mood of the conversation. And so there are many verses like this in the 11th chapter because there's a heightened mood. And Arjuna periodically throughout the Gita, when he has his nervous breakdown at the beginning of the second chapter and other places as well, this meter will be employed. And that's what it communicates. It communicates a change in mood and an escalation in mood. So that's where we are now. Now Krishna's speaking, but Arjuna just asked a question. And so we have to go back to find out what Arjuna's question was because it's relevant to the verse. Arjuna asks, well, he says, Vigyatum ichami bhavantam adhyam. Ichami means I want, I wish, I hope. Ichami. I desire. Gyatum, to know. Bhavantam. You, Adhyam, the original person. I want to know you, O original person. Nahi prajanami tava pravrittam. I don't know your pravritti. I don't know your purpose, your mission, your cause. Pravritti comes from vrit, it means to turn. But anyway, in this case, the way it's used here, it means your cause, your purpose, your mission, what you're doing here. You're showing me this ugra rup, kala rup, adbhuta rup, bhaya rup, ghora rup, a fearful form, what we normally call the kala rup. We call it a kala rup because Krishna says, kala asmi, because I am time. But the words Arjuna uses are a little different. This horrible form, this terrible form, this fierce form. And so he says, what is your pravritti? He doesn't say, he says, I want to know you. I don't understand what your pravritti is, what your purpose is. And then Krishna answers here, my pravritta, the cause of why I've come forth, why I'm here, why I'm in this form is, I'm here, samahartum lokan, to destroy the world. So he's answering Arjuna's question here, and the same word is used. The same word is used. Arjuna's question, or kind of query, what he's thinking, is there, and Krishna uses the same word in his answer. So the purpose of my appearance here is to destroy the world. Rite api tvam. Except for you, or even without you. There's two ways you can render this. Rite api tvam. It can mean even without you, or except for you. Can be used either way. And you're gonna, there's a reason I'm mentioning that. There's a reason I'm mentioning that it can be either one. Rite api tvam. Except for you, or even without you, na bhavishyanti sarve. All will not exist. All ye who are avastitaha, situated here, Pratyanikeshu, on the other side, Anika means an army, and Pratyanika means the other army. Pratyanikeshu, and that other army, all of them who are here now, they all won't exist. They're all going to die, except for you. Or they're all going to die even without you. Either one works. Yoda, that then all the people who are there for the purpose of Yud, for the purpose of fighting, they're all going to die. That's the verse. So somehow or other, Oppenheimer, seeing the massive destructive capability of the first atomic bomb, had the, you know, intelligence and base of knowledge to remember this verse. Okay. Before we read the purport, any questions thus far on the basic meaning, a basic kind of literal understanding of the verse?
I had a question. Well, not about that, but just about, you mentioned whenever there's a change in meter, it indicates
change in mood.
And by the way, that's not me, that's our acharya, so I didn't make that up. I'm just repeating what they said, just so you know. But anyway, go ahead.
That was my question. Like, where did it come
from? Yeah, it's from our acharyas. Yeah. I anticipated that might be the question. I'll tell you when I'm speculating. But usually I try and be a little conservative. That said, I'm going to speculate now. And then, so, you guys, I want to give you a little context. In the 10th chapter of the Gita, Krishna very clearly states that he's God. Kind of unmistakably. Perhaps the clearest verse in the entire Gita where Krishna states his own divinity is Aham Sarvasya Prabhavamata Sarvam Pravartate. He says he's the Alpha and the Omega. He's both the Nimitta Karan and the Upadan Karan. There's two terms from Sanskrit, but those two terms are jointly exhaustive. Those two terms encompass everything. And so when Krishna says Aham Sarvasya Prabhavamata Sarvam Pravartate, early in the 10th chapter, he says that he is the full-fledged manifestation of divinity. He said it throughout the Gita. He's told Arjuna to do bhakti throughout the Gita. Every single chapter of the Gita includes instructions on bhakti. And the fact that we see bhakti as coming from the Gita is just because that's what Krishna puts forward. We really do get to say we do the Gita as it is. We're not making that up. Bhakti is what's taught in the Gita. We can demonstrate that really nicely. Devotees should be able to demonstrate that really nicely to anybody from Shankaracharya down to a person they meet on the street. We have very strong arguments in the Gita. It's not very complicated to learn them. We have, they're just unlimited arguments for bhakti in the Gita. But within that universe of very, very clear instructions that Krishna is God, this one sort of stands head and shoulders above the rest. And Arjuna has a natural response to understanding Krishna's divinity. He gets ecstatic and he says, what is that verse? He says, Param Brahma Param Dhamma Pavitram Paramam Bhavam Purusham Shashvatam Divyam Adi Devam Ajam Vibhumi, glorifies him. But then he asks him a question. He says, I want to understand your vibhutis. Krishna had mentioned vibhutis earlier in the chapter. And Arjuna says, I want to understand your vibhutis. Now, when we hear the word vibhuti, we think of ash coming out of Sai Baba's sleeve. I gave Bhagavatam class the other day, and somebody approached me afterwards. They go, you know, you said prachina barhi. You said that means prachina barhi, who was doing yajnas. And so he had the kusha grass always facing in the eastern direction for doing yajna. But that's not what the word prachin means. The word prachin means old or original. He said, so you made a mistake. And I said, no, I go, that's the meaning of the word. I go, it means original because the original direction the sun comes up in is the east. And so, but the actual meaning of the word is eastern. But somehow or other, the way it's used in modern day Hindi, at least according to what this gentleman told me, was it usually means old. So he was surprised to find out the actual meaning of the word. Similarly, we hear vibhuti and we think Sai Baba giving ash because he's kind of destroyed the term for at least a couple of decades till people forget who he is. And so the term vibhuti really means power, might, opulence, etc. Vibhuti, Aishwarya, they kind of carry the same sort of meaning. And so Arjuna asked Krishna, you've told me that you're God. I want to know how I can see you in this world. This question is extremely important for two reasons. A, if you haven't seen God yet, a bridge to seeing God there is to see God here. Kanishta Bhagavats, or new devotees, they usually think they're a really good devotee, and maybe their guru is also a really good devotee. And everybody else, I'm not seeing them. Maybe, I don't know. A Madhyam Bhagavat is able to see more people. He's able to see Krishna in more people. He's able to give mercy to innocent people and be friends with people who are his peers and avoid envious people, serve more advanced people. He has a much broader perspective. He's able to see Krishna in the world more. And in Uttama Bhagavat, he's able to see Krishna everywhere. Even bad things remind him of Krishna. There are no bad things for him. So this ability to see Krishna around you is actually exactly the scale of how you judge your advancement. If you're in the beginning of your spiritual life and you want to be able to see Krishna everywhere and you want to be able to eventually see Krishna in Sakshat Darshan, you want to be able to see Krishna in his spiritual form, then you start by seeing Krishna here. Instead of looking around the world and thinking, people look around the world and they think everything is up for grabs. You see a beautiful girl or a beautiful boy, and naturally there's this idea that somehow or other they're sort of in the world for your pleasure. Somehow the world is sort of constructed for your enjoyment. It's like Paranjana goes and finds a city and it's like, oh, I'll just move in. Of course, this is insane. If you were walking down the street and there were a bunch of cars parked, you don't just jump into a car and make it yours. But somehow or other, we do this. When you see Krishna in this world, then instead of being filled with a desire to enjoy, you're filled with desire, your like thoughts of reverence and a desire to serve. Seeing things in the world makes you more reverent. You have a sense of reverence and appreciation and servitude. These feelings naturally awaken within you when you see things in relationship to Krishna. I'm just going to give a gross example. It's probably below all of you to hear this, but I'm just going to say it anyway. Imagine if you were thinking that you see some pretty girl and you're thinking, oh, maybe I'll marry her. Or maybe, you know, I'll make her mine. Maybe I'll enjoy her. Girls just do the same with something else. And then you find out that that person is your sister or brother or father or mother. Whatever thoughts you had about enjoying them, what happens to that thought? It just evaporates, doesn't it? And even you feel guilty that even you had such a thought, but if that thought ever, like, whatever that thought was, immediately it evaporates, never to return. That's what happens when you see Krishna in this world. It's curative. It's therapeutic. It's prophylactic. It's antiseptic. It purifies you. So Arjuna asks Krishna, how can I know you in this world? And Krishna explains himself as the superlative example in 70 different categories throughout the 10th chapter. And that's a whole discussion. It's a whole beautiful section. And there's so much value in that. So if you haven't seen Krishna yet, that's a great first step. Or, if you've already got full faith in Krishna, like Arjuna does, because he's saying Param Brahma, Param Dhamma. He's saying that you're the greatest. So he's already got full faith. If you don't have full faith, and you're just starting your spiritual life, this is a great tool for you to help you make advancement, is to see Krishna in this world. But if you already have great faith, then Arjuna still wants to be able to see Krishna in this world. Because he loves Krishna, and he wants to be able to be reminded of him wherever he goes. So whichever place you're at in your spiritual life, Arjuna's request in the 10th chapter and Krishna's reciprocation is very valuable. But it doesn't end there. Finally, Krishna finishes with yat yat vibhuti mat sattvam. Anything you see that's vibhuti mat, anything you see that has any opulence in existence. Mama teja angsa sambhavan. It's just one. It springs from a spark of my splendor. Ekang sena stito jagat. By one fragment of myself, I manifest the whole world. That's how he winds it up. So I gave you an example, but actually everywhere you look, everything you see, that's wonderful. And then the 11th chapter starts. And in the 11th chapter, Arjuna says, I fully accepted what you told me. Could I please see it? Ichami drashtum. I wish to see rupam aishwaram. I wish to see your form of opulence. So the 11th chapter and the 10th chapter fit together like a hand in a glove. It's theory and practice. You follow? Theoretical and applied spirituality. Arjuna gets oriented towards this idea of seeing Krishna everywhere, and he says, can I see it? I want to see it. He starts off by saying, I accept everything you've said is true. Let me just finish real quick. Just hold the mic. Hold the mic. Just 1 second. He starts off by saying, I accept everything is true. Again, even if you've already accepted, still there are desires in transcendence because perfection is not static. Did everybody understand what I just said? Perfection is not static. That means things can be infinite and complete and continue to get better. Somehow we have this idea that perfection means stasis. It just kind of stuck in that state. But of course, what's the meaning of anandam buddhi vardhanam, right? Purna purnatara purnatama. What's the meaning of all this language that we use in our scriptures to indicate Radha and Krishna look at each other, become more and more beautiful, and no one ever accepts defeat, and it goes on forever. So Arjuna, within full faith, still has desires in transcendence. Did everybody follow that? He wants to see Krishna's form. It's natural. Additionally, if you don't have faith, it's still good, because sometimes you need some proof in order to give you faith. So if you don't have faith, like Arjuna, this experience of spiritual truth is essential to build your faith. If you've already got faith, there's still room for desires and transcendence. And the same way it's good either way you slice it in the 10th chapter, also the same logic holds in the 11th chapter. Did you guys follow that? Who didn't follow that? Raise your hand. Let me say it again. In the 10th chapter, Arjuna accepted that Krishna was Param Brahma. But he still wanted to see him. That means that even with full faith, still there's a desire to know God more and more. If you don't have faith, then by knowing God in this world, it acts as a bridge to help you walk towards that world. Transcendence, that's right. In the 11th chapter, he says, okay, you told me, I understand, theoretically, now can I see it, please? If you have full faith, that means there's room within transcendence for more and more desires to get closer and closer to Krishna. If you don't have full faith, raise your hand if you don't have full faith. Okay. So if we don't have full faith, then some positive experience of Krishna, some spurti, is helpful because it helps us to get strength to push forward. So again, this 11th chapter is good for beginners and advanced students alike. The same way I showed how the 10th chapter was good, I'm attempting to show the 11th chapter also has that same benefit. Did you follow it that time? Raise your hand if you still don't follow it. I was going to say I did my best, sorry, but okay, everybody got it, that's great. Your question?
In the first, the shloka purport to the first shloka of Nectar of Instruction, in the very beginning, Srila Prabhupada, an intelligent person hears and then accepts, but less intelligent persons, he sees and then accept. And the same situation is here. Means Arjuna, after hearing, he still want to see. So can you please?
Prabhupada mentions in the Nectar of Instruction, the Upadeshamrita purport to Shloka 1, that there's three kinds of people. One person hears and they learn from hearing. Another person has to hear it and see it. Then another person has to hear it and see it and do it. And then maybe there's another person who hears it, sees it and does it and still doesn't learn. That's actually, it's like an apple and you're comparing it to an orange. This is an orange, that's an apple. They're both about how people learn, but this is about a desire to see God and come closer to God. So I gave an example which was more appropriate. Radharani sees Krishna, and Krishna's so beautiful that when Radharani sees him, because she's made out of Madanakya Mahabhav, she's Mahabhav Swarupini, that's why she's gold, because the color of Madanakya Mahabhav is golden. That's why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had to become golden, because he had to take on her form, Radha Bhava Dyuti Suvalitam. And so when Radharani sees Krishna and she feels love for Krishna, she is love for Krishna, and so she becomes more beautiful. Prapul, she blossoms with love for Krishna. Now Radharani is more beautiful than Krishna, Rasaraj Sri Krishna. He looks at Radharani, who's now more beautiful, and he feels more love. You follow? And although he's Rasikendra, he's Rasaraj, right? He's Rasik Shekhar, he's full of Ras. He's an ocean of Ras. He becomes more beautiful. And they go on like this more and more and more. So the answer to your question is that from the Upadeshamrita purport, you're talking about somebody who has a deficiency and you're trying to cure them of their deficiency. And we're talking about how someone learns who has a problem. You follow? But in the case of Arjuna and Krishna, there's no problem. Things are good. That's why I mentioned that there's two ways of looking at it. The one is if you still need to learn, that's the one that relates to the Upadeshamrita. But then if you've already learned, there's still room for desire in transcendence, meaning you're perfect. Right? Like, for instance, you can take infinity. Can you add numbers to infinity? Yes, you can, in mathematics. And then what number are you left with? Infinity. In fact, you can add infinity to infinity. And what's the result? It's still infinity. You can square it and the result is? You can increase it exponentially and the result still is? There you go. What we're talking about here, strictly speaking, is that Arjuna has desires in transcendence to see Krishna. It's categorically different than someone who needs to learn lessons in life. However, the Upadeshamrita purport is relevant for that person who doesn't have faith and then by this experience does learn. So that purport matches half of the people, because I gave two. I gave two possibilities. So one of them, that purport fits perfectly with. The other one, it doesn't. That's why I gave both, so that questions like this would not arise. Do you understand now? Clear? 100%? You sure? Okay. All right. Okay. If you don't understand me, just tell me. This is me speaking slowly. This is me trying to speak slowly and simply. I'm doing the best I can. I have a nature to speak quickly, especially because I have about 10,000 things I want to cover, and we have limited time. But if I go too quick and you don't follow, just tell me and I'll repeat myself. Or if you have a doubt or you disagree or something like that, feel free to raise your hand. All right, so now Krishna shows Arjuna his Vishwarup, his Viratrup, his Param Aishwaram Rup. And Arjuna's in ecstasy. And I'm guessing none of you have ever watched TV, but I can admit that I've watched TV a few times before. And there's this particular genre of movies called horror movies. Have you ever heard of them? It's a movie where like scary things happen, like a person comes and kills people and he's mean and there's bad music and it's like supposed to make you scared. Gives you vibhatsa ras and bhaya ras. Okay. In a horror movie, the way it works is the movie starts out really nice. And then you're feeling everything's okay. And then it starts to get weird. And then you start to feel weird. And that's the whole idea. It's supposed to create some rust. And so that's the basic schema of your average horror movie. That's kind of what happens here in this chapter. First, it's like 1,000 suns rising in the sky, and Krishna has unlimited helmets, and there's actually a point where Arjuna can see every single thing that's ever existed or will exist in one place at one time. It's this amazing revelation. This amazing revelation. But because he's able to see everything that exists, he also sees death and destruction and pralaya. And so it goes from this kind of like very ecstatic revelation, and then things start to change. And he sees all these warriors rushing into Krishna's mouth, and their teeth, heads are getting caught in between his teeth. Can you imagine? The heads of the warriors are getting caught in between his teeth as he's gnashing down on them. Churnita dangstrananteshu. They're like crushing these heads. And so he gets scared. And he says, and he eventually says, I don't want to see this anymore. Stop, please. But he starts out by saying, I don't get it. I don't understand. And this is Krishna's response. I don't understand your purpose. It started off nice. Now it's changed on me. I don't understand your pravritti. I don't understand your purpose. And Krishna answers, I've come forth. My pravritti is to destroy the worlds and kill everybody. And except for you, everybody dies. And even without you, I'm going to kill everybody anyway. Okay, so now we understand the context of the verse, how it came up, the last chapter or so. We understand where we are in the Gita. Any questions up to this point?
The warriors getting smashed between the Lord's teeth. That's a representation or symbolism of death. Could we consider this to be... I've read somewhere that the Viratrupa is an imaginary form. So is all of this an imaginary form, or is it really that these warriors get smashed between Krishna's teeth?
Well, that's... I mean, I don't recall in the Mahabharata that Krishna jumps down onto the battlefield and eats everybody. So in that sense, I think it's symbolic. In that sense, I think it's reasonable to say it's symbolic because that's not how they meet their end. You follow? You follow? Bhishma and Drona, they don't get eaten by Krishna for lunch. So in that sense, I think it's appropriate to call it symbolic. However, essentially, it's not really so symbolic. Because what does time do? What is time? When Krishna says, time I end, destroy the worlds. Time is death. Time is entropy. There's no other word, so I have to use the word entropy. Who knows what the word entropy is? Raise your hand. Okay. Entropy is the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy is the idea that if you have a closed system, things gradually move from an organized to a chaotic state and they disintegrate. So time disintegrates things. There's one poet, he said, I'm chained to the carcass, to the dead body, to the carcass of a dying animal, and I do not know why. He was talking about old age. Your body disintegrates on you while you're still occupying it. So although the kind of dramatic, sensationalist, flamboyant imagery may be to some extent a symbolic representation that Arjuna was seeing, for all intents and purposes, entropy eats everything. It eats everything. There's a verse in here from the Katha Upanishad, Yasya Brahma Chatram Cha Ubhe Bhavata Odana Mrityu Yasya Upasechanam Ka Ita Veda Yatra Saha. See this verse? This verse says, Yasya, of whom? Brahma Chatram Cha Ubhe Bhavata Odana. The Brahmins and the Kshatriyas are both, they become odana. They become food. For God. They're food for God. Mrityu yasya. And that person for whom? Death. Upasechanam. Upasechanam means a condiment. Or something you sprinkle on top of your meal, like a masala. Or a chutney. Or a sauce. Death is the sauce. So the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas are his lunch, and death is the masala sprinkled on top. Ka ita vete yatra saha. Thus, who can know where that person is, who that person is, what that person is? It's a verse about God in the Katha Upanishad, which Prabhupada quotes in the purport. So this same imagery is used in the Upanishadic literature, even more macabre and scary than the Bhagavad Gita. He's gobbling, he's like a cannibal, eating them for lunch, sprinkling death on top to make that meal more tasty. And so this has the benefit of really reminding us of the temporary world in which we live. So although there is some symbolism, and I think it's just fine to see it like that, there's a very real sense in which this is exactly what happens. Everything is taken away. And a full, complete darshan of the world includes all the beauty and all the other stuff which we usually think is not beautiful. And to be able to be successful in your spiritual life, you have to be able to harmonize those things and not become disgusted by them. And that's why for a devotee, there's nothing bad, because whatever happens is good. Because everything simply becomes an opportunity to become closer to Krishna, and things which normally would be considered bad are not bad because they bring you closer to Krishna. And of course, we give that example, the jaws of death are like a cat's jaws. And if you're a materialist, it's like a cat chewing up a rat. And if you're a devotee, it's like a kitten being picked up by her mother. And you can see a cat, mother cat, grabs the little kitten right here, and the kitten's just kind of super happy and comfortable, and everything's fine because mom's taking him home. Does that speak to what you're saying? Okay. Let's get into the verse and purport a little bit. Prabhupada, as a typical pure devotee and brilliant theologian, explains in his purport the verse that you're reading. And your first job when you read a purport is to figure out how it's explaining the verse that you're reading. So we're going to read the purport, and we're going to stop after each sentence. I can't do this in Bhagavatam class because it's a little more of a formal environment, but I feel a little more appropriate here. We're going to read through the purport, and we're going to stop after each sentence, and we're going to discuss how that purport is linked to the verse. Because everything that Prabhupada says in all of his purports derives from the verse that he's reading. And if you can learn that and figure that out, you get some insight into how pure devotees think, and then you can learn to think like them, which is very, very useful. Okay. I didn't know this for the first 5 years I was a devotee. I read the verses, I read the purports, and I just sort of looked at Prabhupada's books like a bag of spiritual instructions. And I try to find something in there that inspired me. But the idea that every verse is linked to every purport, I didn't figure that out for about, you know, for 5 years. And then I realized there's a whole new world. That each verse, you know, each verse, of course, I was just an idiot, because obviously if Prabhupada wrote a purport, it was intended to explain that verse. That's why he adopted this style of translation. If he just wanted to give general spiritual instructions, he would have written novels. But he chose the traditional way of commenting verse by verse on scripture, because he followed the traditional way of explaining the meaning. And this is true with every purport of every verse that Prabhupada ever wrote. And if you can't figure it out, it just means that you haven't thought about it enough, or you haven't been blessed enough, or you haven't chanted enough japa. Keep going, and you'll find that every purport matches up with every verse. And so as we're reading it, I want you guys to try to match it up. That's why I took the trouble to explain the Sanskrit and the literal translation of the verse, so when we got into the purport, we could really understand what was going on. Although Arjun knew that Krishna was his friend and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he was puzzled by the various forms exhibited by Krishna. What various forms? He hasn't given him the four and two-handed yet, but he gave him the regular form and the universal form, and he gave him one more form. No. Not Chaturbhuj, Sahasrabhuj Vishwarup. Chaturbhuj isn't Vishwarup, four-armed, that's Vishnu. Vishwarup is Sahasrabahu, Kotibahu. But that wasn't the form that led to this question. What was the form that led to this question? The form of death, the Ugrarup, Ghorarup, right? That was the form, Bhayarup. That was the form that Arjuna saw. We call it Kala Roop. That was the form. So he was puzzled by the various forms exhibited by Krishna, especially the one he just exhibited, because he said, I don't understand. This is scaring me. Therefore, he asked further about the actual mission of this devastating force. That further clarifies that it was the devastating form of Krishna that inspired this question. And Prabhupada, just like I did, went back to the previous verse where he said, I don't understand your pravritti, your purpose. Prabhupada is referencing that here because he says he asked further about the actual mission. And if you look at the previous verse, the word for pravritti is mission. So what Prabhupada's doing there is just how I went back to the last verse. I did that because Prabhupada did it. And I wanted you guys to see it. So Prabhupada takes us back one verse, because Krishna here is answering a question. If he's answering a question, you have to know what the question is. Prabhupada's worried we might have forgotten the question in the time it took us to turn the page. And so he's reminding us, because he's expert. It is written in the Vedas that the Supreme Truth destroys everything, even the Brahmanas, as stated in the Katupanishad, and I read that verse. Eventually, all the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and everyone else are devoured like a meal by the Supreme. they're devoured like a meal by the Supreme. So that's a loose paraphrasing of that verse. Of course, Prabhupada is brilliant because he picked a verse from the Katupanishad which exactly speaks to what's going on here, and that's something that Prabhupada typically does. There's two things we just encountered that Prabhupada typically does. He contextualizes for you so you know where you are. That's what he did when he said he was asking about the pravritti. The second thing he does is he provides you with quotations from other books to help validate the verse and sometimes extend its meaning and really increase the impact of it. You thought it was bad, they were getting stuck between the teeth, now they're getting eaten for lunch with a little death sprinkled on top. And so this is something which is traditionally done by our teachers. They quote a verse to augment, substantiate, and further to ratify what the original verse is saying. This form of the Supreme Lord is the all-devouring giant. And Krishna, here Krishna presents himself in that form of all-devouring time. Time again. By the way, we'll get into this in a second. Do you see at the bottom, we're just going to jump down. Do you see at the bottom where it says, time is destruction? The last sentence, time is destruction. That's Prabhupada saying time is entropy. Time is destruction. It's things disintegrating. Time and fire are given as standard examples of God's glory in this world in many religions. That's why we do fire yogas, by the way. Time and fire. Now, why do you guys think that time and fire might be standard examples of God's power in this world? Let me ask a question again. I'm not being rhetorical. Why do you think that time and fire are given in scriptures all over the world as examples of God's vibhuti or aishwarya or power or dominance in this world?
Time destroys everything, gradually and gradually it disintegrates. Fire does the same thing, it burns to ash.
Fire burns things to ashes, time destroys things, and therefore it's given as an example of God because?
He's also he's also one of the features of God, is time I am.
Okay.
We can experience
time and fire right now. The idea that God is in charge of everything is very sort of difficult for people to wrap their heads around. But when you point out to them that time is ticking at every moment, and once a moment is gone, there's nothing you can do to buy it back. And whether you accept it or not, whether you bow down to it or not, it is indefatigably, at all times, without ever lessening, exerting its force on this world and controlling this world. And therefore Krishna's time. Fire can purify anything. It can accept anything which is offered to it. It can actually devour things. You put something in fire, it actually eats it right in front of you like the mouth of God. In this way, time and fire are standard examples of God's power to help people begin to orient themselves towards the idea that there are higher powers in the universe besides themselves. Let's keep going. Except for a few Pandavas, everyone who was present on that battlefield would be devoured by him. Arjuna was not in favor of the fight, and he thought it was better not to fight. Then there would be no frustration. That was Arjuna's thing, right? He didn't want to fight because it looked like an impossible situation, killing his relatives, so he thought maybe I shouldn't fight. So Arjuna wanted to avoid fighting. In reply to that desire not to fight, Krishna said, the Lord is saying, that even if he did not fight, every one of them would be destroyed, for that was his plan. This is very interesting. Remember when I mentioned, Rite Api Tvam could mean except for you, or it could mean even without you? Right? In the verse, Prabhupada says, with the exception of you. In this purport, he says, if Arjuna stopped fighting, stop fighting, then they would die in another way. Even if he did not fight, every one of them would be destroyed. Prabhupada translates the verse twice. Once in the purport, and once in the verse. He conveys both possible meanings, one in the verse, one in the purport. Do you follow that? If you look in the word by word, you'll see rite, without, except for. Without means without you, except for means except for you. In the word by word, he gives both possible meanings. He does one in the translation and the other one in the purport. Did you guys follow that? That's something else Prabhupada does. Now here's a question for you. Which meaning is better? Which rendition is better? He gives both. Which one's better?
Even without you.
Even without you. Why is even without you better?
Because at this time, Arjuna is in the situation that he doesn't want to fight. So this meaning means matches.
Well, I like what you did. He said, without you. Did you all follow what I said? Except for you, everybody's going to die? Or even if you don't fight, everybody's going to die? Two possible meanings of the Sanskrit. Riteya pitvam. Prabhupada does both. I asked which one is better. He said even without you. Why? Because Arjuna didn't want to fight. Of course, there's no indication Arjuna didn't want to fight at this point in the Gita. That's your total mental speculation. It was many chapters ago that Arjuna expressed his desire not to fight. But I like what you're doing. You're trying to find a reason. Let's keep going. Anybody else have like another possibility? Which way of rendering it is better? Yes, Prabhu.
I don't necessarily believe this, but I'll put forward the argument.
Please.
That the other interpretation is better because then Krishna is glorified for protecting his devotees.
That's beautiful. By the way, there are many possible reasons. The only reason I disagree with you is because I can't find what you said. Your point was a general point, and therefore it stands. You tried to say he doesn't want to fight right now, but we're not sure about that. You follow? That might have been many chapters ago. Although as a general point it could work. As a general point it could work. I like this. Krishna shows his bhakta vatsalya. He shows that he protects his devotees. And in this way it's very beautiful. And for devotees this is very meaningful. Our life hinges on this point, that we have faith that Krishna will protect us. That's actually in many ways what it means to be a devotee, is that you have faith in Krishna's protection, in his yoga, in his kshema, in his raksha, right? That's like, which is actually what it means to be a devotee. Very nice point. What else? Which one of these two renditions is better, and why? Whichever one inspires you today, that one is better, right? Whichever one helps you to make the next step today, right? Excellent answer. Very good. Nice answer. What else? Yes?
The first one, because it's in the translation itself.
Okay. The first one, except for you because it's in the translation, right? No, without you because it's in the word by word. Even before the translation. But by the way, I like that. In a translation, that's a good go-to. If Prabhupada puts it in the translation, it usually means that's the one he likes. And it just said previously that it's just a few verses ago. Here we go. Yeah, here we go. All the sons of Dhritarashtra, along with their allied kings and Bhishma, Drona, Karna, and our chief soldiers also, are rushing into your fearful mouths. They're rushing into your fearful mouths. Asmadiyai, along with our Yodha Mukyai, along with our chief soldiers. So, everybody's dying except for a few, and Arjuna's seeing that. Right? So except for a few people, Arjuna just saw everybody, including his own side. That's, by the way, it doesn't say everybody. It says the other side. Pratyani Keshu. But it just said our soldiers too a few verses ago. Prabhupada knows that, and so instead of giving a literal translation, he says everybody on both sides. It's not a literal translation. But it's faithful because it was just seen by Arjuna that the other warriors were rushing into his mouth. Did you follow that? Did you guys follow? Raise your hand if you follow what I just said. Let me try one more time. In the verse it says, Prati Anikeshu. The other side's warriors are going to die. But Prabhupada in this translation says, with the exception of you, all the soldiers here on both sides. That's not what the Sanskrit says. It's not a literal translation. But Arjuna just saw, 3 verses ago or 4 verses ago, he just saw his own soldiers also dying. So although it's not mentioned in this verse, it was just mentioned, and Prabhupada gives a translation kind of the whole section there. You follow? So that people aren't misled. Okay. So, why did I mention that? You said something? What was it? Anyway, I'm going to go.
He said whatever way Krishna increasing their
I don't know how I came up with that from what you said, but anyway, let's keep going. Now, that would support your reading, Brahmachari. That would support your reading. Because except for you, it's just a few verses ago. You follow? So we've got Bhaktivatsalya. We've got a general idea, Arjuna doesn't want to fight, so this one's better. We've got whichever one works for you. We've got, no, I like the one because it's in the translation. And I've added to what you said. I like except for you because just a few verses ago, he saw everybody dying except for them. You follow? But now let's turn the page. Mayaivaite niyatam sapurvameva. I've already killed them. Right? Nimittamacham bhava savya sachin. You can only be the instrument. That means even if you don't fight. You follow? In general, I favor the reading that is closest to the verse in question. You can support either reading excellently, and the Sanskrit is morphable seamlessly for either reading. We find support for the except for you, the Pandavas, a couple verses ago. But we find support for even without you in the next verse. You follow? They're both supportive, but for me, when I'm reading, I like the cleanest version which matches the context the best. Obviously, if Prabhupada says this is what it means, then that's the best version. But when you can go either way on it, I look for the one which is most closely supported by the verses immediately surrounding it. So I like that even if you don't fight one, not because Arjuna was not wanting to fight, which I also think is a good reason, but because the very next verse says exactly that point. Exactly that point. And you see Prabhupada now, he's gone back 1 verse, he's gone back 3 verses, he went forward 1 verse. His whole purpose in the purport is to situate us nicely within the verses so that we can have a very full understanding of the mood and the sentiment of this section. And we'll just finish the purport real quickly. If Arjuna stopped fighting, they would die in another way. Death could not be checked, even if he did not fight. In fact, they were already dead. Time is destruction, and all manifestations are to be vanquished by the desire of the Supreme Lord. That is a law of nature. I just want to finish with this one point. What do you mean that's a law of nature? The law of nature is we're all spiritual beings. Nobody dies. Hang on, I'm going to speak for a second. That was rhetorical. I wasn't looking for an answer. That isn't the law of nature. We're spiritual beings. We never die. Na jayate mriyate vakara chit. We don't die or are born at any moment. That's the main teaching of the Gita. The thing is, Prabhupada in his purports will pick up the flavor of whatever section you happen to be in. And he'll run with that strongly. And so in this section, we're looking at the bare face of material nature. We're looking on that everything material you have that you're attached to is taken away from you. It prompts and gives rise to renunciation. It also helps you to appreciate the awesomeness of God, the adbhuta, aishwarya of the Lord, the kind of wonder-striking in the sense of stuns you, like you're struck with wonder. You're stunned. Chamatkar. You're struck with wonder. And so you get this picture of the deity who's sovereign control of the universe is absolute and indefatigable at every moment. You realize that all of your plans just are washed away. Like moths flying into a fire. Like streams rushing into the ocean. And so in this section, Prabhupada speaks very emphatically. That's the law of nature. Everything is destroyed. Nothing can stop. Everything will be killed. The Brahmanas are the meal. There's a whole thing missing from this purport. You're a spirit soul. You never die. You can connect with Krishna through bhakti yoga. Right? Right? It's because Prabhupada's picking up on the flavor of this section and he runs with it. If Prabhupada said everything in every purport, then every purport would be everything Prabhupada ever said, because everything's connected. So he picked and chose. And so what you do when you study is you pick up on the flavor he's saying. If you're giving a class, maybe you counterbalance it by giving the other side, also from his teachings. Or you just run with it. And you really like sink your teeth into it, to extend that metaphor of chomping and making meals out of people. You sink your teeth into it. And you go with it. Which is what Prabhupada does. Actually, a perfect purport for this section. It really communicates what Arjuna must have been experiencing. Prabhuji?
Actually, Arjuna started asking Krishna to show his form because he was thinking for more. Want to get into more Brahma Sokhya Dharantam. But he ran into a situation where he became scared of. He said, oh, no, who are you? Want to kill? And just take it off. I'm scared. So, was his bliss got interrupted at that point?
Prabhuji's asking me a question about the whole chapter. It's 6:40. I feel like we've gone over time. Okay. He's asking a question. In case you don't know the 11th chapter of the Gita, the question he's asking is that Arjuna said, hey, I want to see that your Aishwarya Roop. And then Krishna said, okay, and he showed him. Then it switched to the Kala Roop, the form of time. So it was like I said, like a horror movie. It was like the pretty thing, beautiful, sunny skies, lots of suns, brilliant helmets, lots of jewelry. And then it switched. Head getting gnashed, moths flying into a fire, flames, tusks, fierce. And at a certain point, Arjuna said, I've had enough. I can't take it anymore. And then Krishna withdrew that form and showed him his Chaturbhuj Roop and then his Saumya Vapu, his beautiful form, two-armed form, Manushim Roop. So this is the story. So he's saying what happened. Was it too much for Arjuna? Was it beyond his realization? He's asking, right? Like, what happened? There's kind of two ways of looking at it. So the general way of looking at it, which is probably how I would answer this question if somebody asked me and it was a larger gathering of non-devotees or young devotees, I would give a simple answer. The simple answer is that the full-fledged revelation of God's glory and power, you know, is too much. And so we can take as much as we can take. But it was too much. And so, you know, we can't understand everything. We can understand enough to love God. And kind of Arjuna went to that limit. He sort of temporarily flew up in a plane. And at a certain point, he had to come back down. And so this universal vision of the absolute truth is more than our minds can contain. Even our chit anu, our hearts may not be able to contain that complete revelation. Krishna is unlimited. We can only taste. That's why he said, "Ek ang sena sito jagat." Just one little tiny piece of myself. I do everything. And so, a general understanding is that Arjuna flew up in the sky, right, with the divya chakshush that Krishna gave him. He took it as far as he could go, and eventually, it was too much. And I think that's a nice understanding. It makes us humble. We realize there's much more than we can ever understand. And it fills us with a sense of reverence that God is unlimited, that Krishna is unlimited. And it kind of humbles us, and in that humble state, vidyadadati vinayam, that knowledge gives humility. We can actually acquire knowledge in that humble state. That's answer A. call that like a beginning answer. Answer B, a little bit different. Here's how our acharyas understand this particular pastime. Arjuna is a pure devotee. He's a pure devotee. He is up here. The Vishvarupa is down here. Arjuna has Sakya and praying for Krishna. Vishvarupa is down here, just like Vishnu is below Krishna. I don't want to get into a whole explanation. We can, but it'll take us longer than we have time for. Vishnu is below Krishna. Arjuna came down. Where are we? We're down here. We want to come up. Remember how I said there's two ways of viewing it? Same model, two ways of viewing it. Arjuna comes down, his act of coming down creates a bridge for us to go up. You follow? It's a good thing. Arjuna's here, we're here, Vishwarupa is here. Arjuna stepped down to the Vishwarupa. He loved Krishna purely. His love for Krishna was so pure that there was no sense of divinity. That's a higher love. That's a deeper love. That's a more profound love. The whole idea of Vrindavan, of Krishna wearing a Vanamali, peacock feather decorating his hair, is based on this idea that the more intimacy, the higher the love is. That's in fact why we see Krishna as being Swayam Bhagavan. So, Arjuna came down, the Divya Chakshush was like kind of like demigod's eyes. Below the Shuddha Bhakta, Premika eyes he had. Below the Premanjana eyes he had. The eyes smeared with the Anjana of Prem. Below that, he came down, he saw it, and eventually was like, I don't want this. Yeah, okay, it was fun. Like, you go on like a trip, like, it's fun, you know, like you go on a roller coaster ride, it's like, okay, finished. I'll go back to my family, be peaceful. And so when he went back to the Chaturbhuj and then the Somyavapa, which we see as a covert reference to a Manushimtanum, to a two-armed form, then he was going back to his original higher place. And he's of course indicating to us that we should go up to the higher place too. And so the Vishwarupa Darshan was designed to give us a sense of Krishna's majesty, to help us go up, but then we don't stop, we continue to follow Arjuna to the next level up. Does that answer your question? Good question. More question, discussion? Yes.
If we turn to text 4 of this chapter, then there Arjuna requested that if you think that I am able to behold your cosmic form, then kindly show me that unlimited universal self. And so,
hey, I quoted this. Drashtu ichami te rupam aishwadam purushottamam.
Text 4.
Oh, text 3. Text 4.
Yeah.
Manyase yadi tat shakyam maya drashtum iti prabho. O Prabhu, O Prabhu, if you think I am able, if you think I am able, if you think it's able to be seen by me, this form, Yogeshwar tato me tvam darshaya atmanam avyayam. So if you think I'm able to see this, your form, O Lord, O Yogeshwar, then you please show me, you please show me your avyaya atmanam, you please show me your eternal self. Yeah.
Arjuna saw the form, and then after he is now bewildered.
Yes.
So, does it mean then that Krishna doesn't consider this statement fully?
I don't understand what you're asking.
Means, here Arjuna is asking that if you think that I am able to see your form,
yes,
then please reveal to me.
Yes. Krishna revealed.
And then Krishna revealed.
And then he got scared.
Yeah, and he became scared and bewildered.
Yes.
So he was not able to behold the form.
Maybe he was able to see it, but he wasn't able to contain it.
Able to see what?
He was able to see it. Like if I say to you, you say to me, hey, I want to help you carry your bags to the car. I'm going to the car, I have a lot of bags. And you say, hey, I want to help you carry your bags. And I said, my bags are kind of heavy, you look kind of skinny. And he said, no, I want to help you. Because you're a Brahman and you're not a coolie, then you take the bag, you put it on your head, and you fall because the bag's so heavy. Right? I'm happy you carry my bags. Here, take my bag. You can't carry it, that's okay. But that doesn't mean so. He saw it, but he wasn't able to fully carry it. For a little time he could, but it got too heavy for him. So he said, Krishna, can you carry your own bag? I helped you for a little while, I can't carry it anymore. So that was my first explanation. The explanation I gave him, exactly I'm repeating in different language the same thing I just said to him. Explanation number one. I'm saying the same thing to you now I just said to him. That he said, if you think I can hold it, Krishna goes, yeah, here you go. And he goes, oh, take it back, please. Okay, you asked, I gave. You don't want any more? No problem. Krishna's so amazing, even Arjuna could not fully understand. Like this, we can understand. It's okay. But for us, we can't understand like that. Because Arjuna is beyond any Vishwa Rup Darshan. So for us, the other explanation is there. And we have little things in there. Little things in there to indicate this. Remember how I said before that every single chapter of the Gita, without exception, teaches Bhakti Yoga? I made that bold proclamation at the beginning of class? Let's just look at that real quick. As long as we're here, let's just look at that real quick. Let's look at text 53 and 54. Just very briefly. Fifty-three is a precursor. Na ham vairai, na tapasa, na dhanena, na cha ijaya. Not by studying the Vedas. Not by doing tapasya. Not by giving charity. Not by doing worship. Shakya evam vidha drashtum. Are you able to see me? It's exactly the same language that Arjuna just used. If you think I'm able to see, Krishna says you're not able to see by doing any of these things. Drishtavan asi mam yata. Is someone able to see me as you have seen me? I just showed you my form. Of course, the question now is which form is he talking about right now? That's a whole other. It's a two-arm form according to our acharyas. Everybody else thinks it's a Vishwarupa darshan, but for our acharyas it's a two-arm form because it mentions the Manushyam Rupa in the previous verse. In the previous verse, it says, Arjuna says, drist va idam manusham rupam. Now seeing this human-like form, I'm like pleased. And then Krishna says, and he says, you're not able to see this. You're not able to see this. He actually uses the word idam. You're not able to see this. Idam rupam, this form. Idam means this form right here. You follow? It doesn't mean that form. It means this form right here. You follow? Tat rupam, that form. Idam rupam, this form right here. Can't see this form. This two-arm form. That's for you. And anybody else who understood that other explanation I gave. So he says here, you can't see me by yajna, by worship, by tapa, austerity, by study. You can't see me. What's the big glaring question you would want to ask right now? How can I see you? This is like all the things we do, so these things don't work if all the standard religious processes that have been recommended all over the Vedic literature don't work to see the form I just saw. Then what does work? Right? And then the next verse comes, like a shower of nectar on us. Bhaktya tu ananyaya shakya aham evam vidha arjuna. By unalloyed bhakti you are able to. Gyatum, to know me. Drashtum, to see me. Tatvena, in truth. Praveshtum, and enter into this understanding. So my bhakti is in every single chapter. It's in every chapter. And it's in every chapter like this. It's contrasted. It's called contrapositioning. You take one thing, you put it over here. You take something else, put it over here. And it clearly indicates not by this, only by this. It really emphatically makes the point. Now you may be wondering, what does that bhakti look like? Like how do I live that life of ananya bhakti? Unalloyed devotion that you're indicating here. Like the Hare Krishnas were right. They say it's all about unalloyed devotion. And Krishna himself is saying the same thing. They were right. But what does that actually mean? How do I live that? And then the next verse. The final verse of the chapter. Mat karma krit, work for me. Mat parama, see me as the supreme. Mat bhakta, be my devotee. Sangha vajita, give up bad association. Nir vaira sarva bhuteshu, don't be envious of other beings. Don't be envious of other beings. Why should you not be envious of other beings? Because they're part of me. I just showed you my Vishwarupa Darshan. You saw everybody inside me. You follow? You just saw it. So now you can't anymore be hateful of anybody else because you've seen that I'm in everything and everything's in me. Yasamam eti pandava. And that's how you'll come to me. One who does that, that's how he comes to me.
Does it mean that we are envious to Krishna?
Huh?
If everybody is in you, that means we are envious to Krishna.
Krishna says this. Yeah. Yeah, Krishna says this. He says, austerity in the mode of ignorance. You torture him in your own body and in the bodies of others. So like all these heavy tapasyas you see people doing in the 17th chapter, he says he doesn't approve of this because you torture him in your own body and in the bodies of others. Absolutely. There's no place for that. That's right. Absolutely. That's why you have to offer your respect even to a blade of grass. Because the Lord's everywhere. And that's the Uttama Bhagavat's vision. He sees that. Krishna's given us a little taste of this, and this is what we're supposed to live. Now we have a very sweet Madhurya way we do this. It's a very sweet conception. It's a very sweet reconciliation, harmonization. This is kind of, this is a general idea, but the way this plays out in Vrindavan and the sweetness of Vrindavan is especially sweet, and that's one of the specialities of our lineage. It's the same Siddhanta, the same Tattva, the same truth is there, but we experience it in a very magical way. In a very magical way. In fact, this is the Ras Lila, actually. Everyone is cooperating together to serve Krishna. And even the plants and trees. Prabhupada one time says that the trees and the grass argue in Goloka Vrindavan. He told Mukunda Maharaj this. The trees say, you're the best devotee to the grass. And the grass says, why? And the trees say, because Krishna's always stepping on you with his lotus feet. You're so fortunate. And the grass says, I'm not so fortunate. Maybe he steps on me. But you're always serving him by giving him shade. I see the way you grow and you bow down and you cover him so that the sun never touches him. And you give him nice fruits and shady places and kunjas. You're the best devotee. And like this, there's a harmony. There's a universal vision. There's a Vishwarup Darshan amongst the residents of Vrindavan. That's about serving Krishna purely. Final points?
From this kind of heart would lead to this enjoying propensity that if I enjoy, Krishna is enjoying. Let me have, let everybody enjoy their senses. And that could lead Krishna.
What a horrible thought. Krishna says, Yo mam eva masamudho janati purushottamam. If you know me as Purushottam, okay, as the Supreme Lord, sasadavit, you know everything, bhajati mam sava bhavena, and you worship me with your heart. The result of actually understanding Krishna as he is that you fall in love with him and you serve him. That is the natural result. So if you have an enjoying propensity, we can understand you don't know Krishna. To actually understand how everything is connected, how Krishna is the center, how you're connected through bhakti to Krishna. You don't think I'm enjoying in that way Krishna's enjoying. You have this sweetness of bhakti, and that connection becomes very strong through bhakti. And you never want to do anything but that bhakti because you relish so much more happiness as a servant with a bhakta bhav. Krishna says the same thing in the 10th chapter, Aham sarvasya prabhavo, mata sarvam pravartate, I'm the master of everything, iti matva. Thus, understanding this, bhajanti mam, buddha bhava samanvita. Endowed with great faith, great love, they worship me. Buddha, they're intelligent, and they worship me. It's a beautiful verse, because normally you think someone's philosophically astute, they're intellectually capable, or they're ecstatic. And emotional. Krishna puts both those ideas together. Buddha, they're enlightened, bhava samanvit, and they're endowed with bhav. So, my experience is just the opposite. Any kind of spiritual realization I've ever had has filled me with great humility and made me want to dedicate millions of lifetimes to Krishna. Maybe that realization is fledgling, maybe it's just an abhas, I don't know. But at least I can speak concretely from my own experience. That any revelation of Krishna's wonder has filled me with feelings of a desire to serve and made me feel terrible for any enjoying I've ever done in my life. How about everybody else? You have the same experience? How about everybody have the same experience? When you realize Krishna's sweetness, when you're chanting japa, when you're seeing the deities, when you're doing seva, do you think like, let me go and eat a big plate of prasad and be the enjoyer because Krishna's enjoying through me? We don't think like this. We don't think like this. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. It's like if somebody says, there's a surgeon, he does surgery, it heals you. And then you say, well, what if you just start cutting limbs off? It's so against the nature of a surgeon to do that. He just wants to help people. So his usage of that tool is very precise. You follow? So to actually engage in bhakti, to have such a realization, means you've already learned these lessons that you're not the enjoyer. That thing won't come back. Jiva Goswami makes this point. Krishna gives you a special realization so it doesn't come back. It's 7 o'clock. Can we call it a day? Thank you very, very much. Hare Krishna.
Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda.